And now it's that time of year again. We're hearing Christmas Time Is Here by Vince Guaraldi, which is featured in the classic holiday special, A Charlie Brown Christmas.
And that's one of our next guest's favorite holiday specials. And we want to know what your favorite holiday movie or TV special is now at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite movies to watch this time of year? What do you think is the best holiday movie of all time? Is there one that you watch every year on the holidays? Call in and share your favorites right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mike Mayo joins us now. He's a film critic and novelist whose latest book is called Jimmy and Faye, a suspense novel. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
This is going to sound so corny, but hearing that music makes it Christmas. And this is the first time I have heard it this year. And really, the Vince Guaraldi music for the Peanuts special, I think, is, if not the main reason, certainly a very important reason that has remained such a favorite for everybody, because that music just sets that kind of sad but happy mood so well that it makes Christmas, and now we are officially in Christmas season from my point of view.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I had the exact same reaction, and then I wondered why it made me feel sort of happy, because it was kind of sad music.
It is, that is such an interesting little show. The 30-minute Charlie Brown Christmas ends with the reading, of Linus reading the Bible, and it is just so much what we don't think of as Christmas now, but yet it is so perfectly Christmas. And we love those characters so much, the simplicity of it. It is just one that we have to watch over and over again.
Before we get into more Christmas specials and movies, I understand you have a favorite Thanksgiving movie you can tell us about.
Well, it is one of my all-time favorite movies ever, really, and it's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. To me, it's just the perfect pairing of Steve Martin and John Candy, and this kind of basic, simple story of this guy who wants to get home to his family and all the things that conspire against him. I just wish that the one scene in it that has all the profanity, I kind of wish they'd bleep that out or something, because I know that really bothers some people, but I still think it is just an absolutely wonderful movie, and it's one, again, that I can watch again every year.
Well, here's a listen to Steve Martin here. Hopefully it's not the clip you just mentioned. Let's give a listen.
I mean, didn't you notice on the plane when you started talking, eventually I started reading the vomit bag? Everything is not an anecdote. You have to discriminate. You choose things that are funny or mildly amusing or interesting. You're a miracle. Your stories have none of that. They're not even amusing accidentally. I could tolerate any insurance seminar. For days I could sit there and listen to them go on and on with a big smile on my face. And I'd say, how can you stand it? And I'd say, because I've been with Del Griffin.
Steve Martin yelling at the late John Candy. It ends up having a happy, redemptive message at the end, too.
Right, it is heartwarming.
This is a wonderful movie.
Not totally kid-appropriate. I tried to watch it with my kids, as you said, and I realized, I guess there is, some
stuff
in
here. Stuff
you forget
sometimes,
about.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, you're also looking at some of the movies we may not know as much about, like one called The Desk Set. Tell us about that one.
This is a wonderful movie from kind of the late 50s. It is a Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn movie, and I don't know why it's not better known. It doesn't begin as a Christmas movie. It has the big finish at Christmas. It's going to be showing up on Turner Classic Movies later this month, but it's just maybe not their best together, but they are just so comfortable in it. It's set in a big New York office building where Spencer Tracy is this guy who is trying to bring in a new computer. Katharine Hepburn works in the research department there, and everyone's afraid that the computer is going to replace them. This was really kind of at the very beginning of the Mad Men era, and so it's got much that same ethos going on. And just the two of them working as just, really kind of these just such an old, comfortable pair together. Again, it's one I can just rewatch every year. And I plan to again this year because I just went out and bought another DVD of it.
Well, here's a little listen to the desk set.
Oh, Mike, the earrings. Oh, they're so beautiful with the ring.
You like them?
Oh, they're lovely.
You like
you
them?
You are an angel. Oh, thank you. I can't give you yours now. It's just too silly.
Oh, as long as it's not a robe.
Well, it's as far away from a robe, Mike, as I could possibly get.
Thank you. Bongo drums. How did you know?
Well, there was a sign over them that said for the man who has absolutely everything.
Have I?
Has he?
Clip from the desk set there as we talk about the best holiday movies and TV specials of all time with film critic Mike Mayo. You can share your favorites at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite holiday film that you keep going back to? This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up the holiday movie discussion with film critic and novelist Mike Mayo.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite holiday movie? Maybe there's one you watch every year around this time, maybe when you're together with the family. Join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Jordan on the line in Menasha. Jordan, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to throw into the mix?
I wanted to throw White Christmas into the mix.
Ah. What do you like about it?
I like that it's a nice musical, it's family-friendly, and we go back to it year after year.
Jordan, thanks for that. You know, that's what I kind of overlook, Mike. Make the case for White Christmas.
It like you said, this is just a really nice musical done at the kind of the height of the musical with really good stars in it too. And as you said, family friendly. When you go into the newer stuff, almost any of it, you start running into things, as you noted earlier, with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles that may be inappropriate. And I think a lot of Christmas movies, the enjoyment of them is to watch them in big groups. It's not something you just sit down and do by yourself. You've got family and friends over too, so you don't want to be showing anything that's going to make anybody uncomfortable. And when you get into the newer things, that's always a possibility.
We also heard, thanks for that call, Jordan. We heard from Carolyn from La Crosse recommending, this is a made-for-TV movie, she said, Eve's Christmas. That's one that struck her and she likes to go back to. Well, let's take it to a little darker place here with a somewhat more recent one than White Christmas. Scrooged, Bill Murray, updated take on Ebenezer Scrooge. Is that one that you go back to, Mike?
I love this movie, and again, it's one I don't watch it every year. I can't say that, but I see it regularly, and it kind of goes into some of the things we were talking about. A little stuff that get some of the violence gets a little strong, maybe for a Christmas movie, but it comes to such a wonderful ending. I love Bill Murray's long speech at the end. I wish we had time to play it all because it is so beautiful. But for those who don't know it, it is Bill Murray as a TV network executive on Christmas Eve who goes through the same thing that Ebenezer Scrooge does, going back to visit his past and alternate futures and things like that. Just very, very nice. And I think some of Bill Murray's best work that he's never really been recognized for.
Here's a listen. This is Bill Murray before his epiphany.
Well, my problem is, Miss Little Fella.
Oh.
I can't get the antlers glued onto this little guy. We've tried crazy glue, but it don't work.
Have you tried staples?
Staples?
Don't you dare. If you staple that little mouse, I'll call the Humane Society. I'm not kidding.
I wouldn't do anything in the world to hurt this little fellow.
Hey, Marlin, Perkins, the road.
I have three dogs and a cat at home.
Beautiful story. Tell Reader's Digest, will you?
Not a super sympathetic character up till the end, Bill Murray and Scrooge there.
We got a caller now. Oh, go ahead, Mike.
And he does things that are even nastier than that at the beginning of the movie.
Let's go back to the callers. We see we've got Brian in Superior. Brian, hi.
Hi. I guess one of my top movies would have to be Holiday Inn. The song that was introduced was White Christmas and also Easter Parade. And all, like, dozen songs are all by Irving Berlin at the top of his form. I mean, it's just win, win, win. It's such an enjoyable, you know, schmaltzy story.
Well, cool, Brian. Thanks for bringing that up. I did not know about Holiday Inn. What can you tell us about that one, Mike?
Yeah, it's it's another one. And like you said, it's the Irving Berlin songs that make it. And I think to an older generation, which I am quickly becoming a part of, that those songs really have a great nostalgic value. I am not sure that younger viewers will be as patient with that, and you may have a hard time getting them to sit down in front of the TV and watch that with you.
Brian, thanks for the call. And Mike, Brian said a bit schmaltzy, the plot line, but hey, if you can't take some schmaltz in your holiday movie, when can you take some schmaltz?
Exactly. there is a fine line here, but I think with holiday movies, we tend to be perhaps more forgiving than we are with other kinds of movies.
So, Mike, this year I feel like for the first time I've seen a new addition to sort of the holiday canon, and that's the movie Gremlins, which I thought was sort of, you know, stuffed back in the dustbin of, what was this, the 80s or something like that? But now it's, I guess, a holiday movie. What's the case
right.
for Gremlins?
Yeah, it has, remember, it is set in the same town that It's a Wonderful Life is set in, the name of the town, and it's got a lot of big Christmas stuff in it. That's a very important element. And also, it's the same with Gremlins 2, which is a very underrated sequel that's set, again, in a New York office building. But, yeah. Yes, Gremlins, we don't think of it as a Christmas movie because there's so much else going on, but that's the way it ends. And again, worth another look for those who haven't seen it in a long time. I have to say it's not one of my own favorites, but I know it gets a lot of love from people because of just the inventive effects and the just kind of curious aspect of the storytelling in it.
Here's a little taste of Gremlins.
Christmas carolers. I hate Christmas carolers. Screeching voice of blue snippers.
I warned you, Brad!
That would be the Gremlin Christmas carolers there.
I couldn't really quite make out what tune they were singing.
Yeah, I don't think that's the important bit for a Gremlin. So, Mike, leave us with maybe your favorite TV classic to watch coming up next, or maybe a more recent addition to the Christmas movie canon.
The one that has, I'm really surprised at how popular it is. We showed it here at my neighborhood group last year with a lot of people, and it really stands up well. And that is Love Actually from, I can't remember exactly when it was, about 10 or 15 years ago. It's one of the movies that has a really big ensemble cast, and it's telling four or five different stories all the way through. It's mostly British. This is the movie that kind of introduced Bill Nighy to a lot of American audiences. Emma Thompson is in it too. Just a terrific movie. Not all the parts of it work perfectly, but taken all together, it is really an enjoyable movie. Again, it's got some things in it that are probably a little strong for younger audiences,
right.
But a really good movie.
Mike, thanks a lot. Always a lot of fun to talk to you.
Thanks for inviting me.
That's Mike Mayo, film critic and novelist. You can keep sharing your favorite holiday movies on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's our winter, year-end winter membership drive. You can make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As President-elect Donald Trump prepares to enter the White House, the public and the press are still recovering from a race that was characterized by a frustrated electorate, breaks from traditional politics, and scandal. Now the media is gearing up to cover a new president, a president who had some of his most quotable moments on Twitter and who has also been open about his criticisms of the press.
And even though the election has wrapped up, post-mortem conversations among journalists, analysts, communities, and families are likely to continue. Tomorrow there will be a panel discussion at Madison's Overture Center on ethics and the 2016 election, sponsored by the UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics.
Molly Ball will be one of the panelists at tomorrow's event, and she joins us in studio now. She's a national political reporter for The Atlantic. She's currently the December Writer-in-Residence at UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you wrote a piece in The Atlantic back in June. It was called Stop Blaming the Media for Trump. And in that piece, you talked about media being blamed for his rise in the primaries because of the amount of attention that he got from journalists. Do you still stand by that argument? Do you feel like Trump's critics blame the media too much for his rise?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as a political reporter, I've been hearing a lot of anger at the media from both sides. The Clinton campaign believes that she lost in part because the media was unfair to her. The Trump campaign, as you noted, has and Trump himself have been very antagonistic toward a media that they believe is dishonest and not fair to President-elect Trump. And I believe that we are doing our jobs to find the truth and represent the facts without fear or favor. But there have been a lot. There is a lot of anger directed at the media right now, and a lot of that is exacerbated by the candidates. As I mentioned, both candidates dislike the media. One was much more forward about it than the other, and to have a major party nominee and now president-elect like Donald Trump, who called out individual reporters and who attacked the media often without cause, and who really, I think, saw it as a campaign tactic to turn his followers against the media so that they would believe him in the face of the facts in many instances. That has contributed to an even more toxic atmosphere than I'm used to, because it's certainly nothing new for political reporters to be disliked.
And what do you think about how that played into what happened during the election? The media did get dinged in this election. I mean, we've seen trust eroding in other institutions like Congress, for example. If you look further afield, religion. Now the media, it does seem like, took a hit during this election. I mean, what do you make of that and that general sentiment combined with how this election went over with voters?
Well, I think you make a very smart point, which is that the decline in trust in the media is of a piece with decline in trust in all sorts of institutions in our society. But it's certainly true that when you look at polls, people used to trust the media a lot more than they do now. I think part of that is certainly the internet and social media and the proliferation of new sources of information that allow people to find the news that flatters their assumptions and reject contrary facts. I am lucky to work at an institution that seeks to confront people with the truth, whether they like it or not. And I hope that there's still a market for that. I believe there's still a market for that. While I certainly have experienced people's lack of trust in the media for a long time as a political reporter, it clearly is increasing.
Well, the New York Times, among other media outlets, their subscriptions went up some 40,000. And that's not the only news outlet that saw that sort of spike after the election. So does that tell a different narrative that maybe there is this market, as you're saying, for people who are really looking for substantive, fact-based journalism?
Well, we've seen our subscriptions increase at The Atlantic as well. And what I've seen from the beginning of covering this election, I mean, this election is probably the biggest political story I've ever covered. And it is fascinating and perplexing to many people. So there is a lot of interest in reporting that is nuanced and that contextualizes a new and shocking and unprecedented phenomenon and helps people to understand it. So, you know, we've seen record web traffic at theatlantic.com. We've seen new subscriptions to The Atlantic magazine, which, of course, everyone should give their families as a Christmas gift this season. but I think that reflects people's hunger for answers in a time when there are a lot of questions, and they are gratifyingly not just to our bottom line, but to my sense of civic responsibility, they are turning to institutions like The Atlantic that do seek out the truth to try and find those answers.
You had a conversation with Vox's Ezra Klein back in September, and I want to play a little bit of that now.
I feel like that's been one of my potentially learning experiences of this election, that maybe elections were never really about ideas. Maybe they were always about these issues of identity and tribe and people's sense of where the interests of their group lie and who they identify with.
So you're saying there that maybe elections are not about ideas, and you think about election platforms, they should be, I guess, built on the ideas of the candidates, but you're saying that was a big lesson for you. Do you still think that you had maybe a different focus you could have pulled to, and that was what people, how people relate to the politics and what they're living?
Absolutely. Thank you for quoting me to myself. I did. This election really did change the way I think about and understand politics. I think it would be very disingenuous to claim that this election was a referendum on, you know, Donald Trump's tax plan on his website versus the tax plan that Hillary Clinton put on her website. It was very clear to me covering this election, and the way I cover the story is to try to cover what's actually happening out there in American politics. It was very clear to me that that was not the basis on which voters were making their decision. Now, I have friends in political science who tell me I was naive to think that politics was ever a contest of ideas, that it really always has been a contest more of identities and people's tribalism deep down. But that is really the view that I developed in covering this campaign. And, you know, I realized very early on covering Donald Trump that something was happening out there that I didn't understand. And my reaction to that as a reporter is always to investigate, to go out and try to get my head around what's happening, talking to people, talking to sources, going different places, bearing witness to events, and trying to explain to readers this new phenomenon that I really think did in many ways change the face of American politics. But to have the curiosity as a reporter to say, and the humility to say, that this is not something that I understand and can explain to you, I have to go out and figure it out through reporting.
We heard the phrase media elites a lot during this campaign. And when you think about what happened, certainly a lot of voting action happened on the East Coast, but a lot of it, you know, happened in the middle of the country, sort of flyover country, where it may be that reporters are not based so often. And if they are based there, maybe they fly in, they visit, they talk to a few people, and then they fly out again. I mean, do you think that we need to be more regional in the way that we cover the country to really have a sense of what's going on?
Yeah, well, I am one of those national reporters who parachute in and then leave. But it's taken me, you know, to places like Wisconsin many times and all over the country. And I think that I draw my perspective as a national reporter from traveling all around. I don't spend a lot of my time in Washington in the Beltway. I'm always out there trying to talk to people and understand where they're coming from. Now, the people in the heartland don't have a monopoly on real America. People in Washington and New York City are also real Americans. I was a local reporter in the Southwest, which is a region that also often gets ignored by the coastal media. I was a local reporter in Las Vegas for 5.5 years, and that really developed my perspective in being on the ground, understanding a local population that was not part of the coasts. And so that's another place that I have returned to as a national reporter and that contributes to my understanding. So I would say absolutely journalists need to get out of the cities and get out of the corridors of power. But the people who do that more than anyone are campaign reporters. Campaign reporters spend the great proportion of their time traveling around America and trying to listen to and to understand the people who really drive American politics, and that's the voters.
So what's next for the media? I know that's a big thing to say because the media is not a monolith. There's all different approaches to the media, but all kinds of questions being raised right now about where the media goes next, how it should best cover Donald Trump. There is this precedent of this contentious relationship already going forward and some norms that we've come to expect from the way the press pool covers the president have already seemed to be eroding or at least changing a little bit. So what do you think the media should do to best cover this presidency?
Well, fortunately for me and probably for America, I do not run the media. So I can really only speak to how I plan to approach the story. But it as I said before, it's a big story, an unprecedented story, a story that a lot of people are looking to us for answers, and so we just have to keep covering it as best we can, trying to find out what's true and trying to tell people what the truth is. And that means not, you know, the journalism slogan, without fear or favor. That means that we cannot be intimidated by attacks from a candidate or his or her supporters. And we've got to continue to serve our audience. You know, when Donald Trump has declared war on the media, and I think the last thing we should do is engage in that fight, declare war back, because that's basically taking the bait. He wants to be in a fight with us, but we are not fighting. We're not a self-interested. He sees us as a self-interested lobbying group for our own interests versus his. our interests are our readers' interests. We have to serve our readers and serve the public and keep our focus on finding the truth and giving it to people, not on advocacy for the interests of the media.
Molly, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Great conversation.
That was Molly Ball. She's a national political reporter for The Atlantic, and she's currently the December Writer-in-Residence at UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics.